Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. We've got Tom Schultz with us. Tom is a bird artist and illustrator. As I said, he's illustrated a lot of field guides, been birding for over 40 years as a board member and past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. So we're going to switch our attention from bird eggs. Oh, maybe we can talk a little bit about bird eggs with Tom, but to talk about birds in general and what you're seeing out there these days as you walk around outside in the out of doors. And I hope you'll join in with your bird questions today. We've got a great opportunity to spend a little more time. Normally, I have to say, in past years, it's been a tradition on the show to talk about bird watching, and I wanted to. We sort of lost a big holiday or two, just because of changes that were going on at the station and so forth. But I'm really glad to be able to bring this back because it's always a very popular show. Bill Volker will be with us a little later on when he gets here. Retired DNR educator and naturalist. But right now, Tom Schultz is with. Tom, are you there?
I'm here, Larry. Well, happy to join you a little bit early today.
Oh, well, I'm great to have you. It's great that you're able to join in early and talk with us about the birds. I know some of our birds have already migrated. Let's give our listeners a chance to join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And we'd certainly love to hear what you've been seeing or experiences that you've had with birds recently or even further back. Tom, some of our birds have already migrated, I guess. Which species are we going to be seeing right about now?
Well, the process sort of begins after the breeding season. Some birds remain in the area, even though they become much more quiet once the breeding season and nesting is over. But then they slowly start to leave, and it gets very difficult to determine exactly which birds are still present and which ones are not, unless you happen to see them out in the field. But there are some that do tend to leave early, some of the flycatchers. One of the first birds to leave in the late summer is the yellow warbler, which is usually gone sometime in August, for the most part anyway. There are some yellow warblers, some subspecies that nest up in Canada that come through a little bit later, and they're a little darker colored, so you can tell them apart to some extent. Baltimore Orioles have left for the most part. There's still a few around. But I know the numbers at our feeders have declined, and they're almost, I haven't seen one here in probably 2 weeks.
Yeah, where do the Orioles migrate to?
Central America. I know that when I lead a field trip down to Costa Rica for their WSO, the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, every couple of years, we do see some Baltimore Orioles down there on their wintering grounds. So they're in the tropics for the winter season. They're primarily insectivorous birds, and of course, once fall and winter arrives, insects become
they better get out of here.
Impossible to find.
Are we seeing some new birds coming through Wisconsin on their way south? Anything different?
Yeah, there are birds. Some birds, for example, that nest in the northern part of the state or up in Canada are starting to show up in the southern part of the state. For an example, the olive-sided flycatcher is moving through, and they'll mostly be gone within the next week or so. They're a fairly early migrant. Another one would be the common nighthawk. And I'm guessing that a lot of your listeners have been seeing common nighthawks. I think their numbers have declined now, or I should say the number of migrants. In general, their numbers have declined just because they're in some trouble, I think, due to the decline of aerial insects. There are a number of factors for that, and we don't entirely understand all the reasons, but nighthawk numbers are generally down, but they do migrate mm-hmm. through the last couple weeks in August. And so late in the day, you'll see sometimes a flock of 10 or 50 or 100 sometimes flying through, usually low over the ground. They sort of look like big bats when they're flying. Have a real distinctive look.
What do they primarily feast on?
That would be the aerial insects, large moths, or other large flying flying insects that they catch on the wing. They have it's kind of interesting. When you look at a common nighthawk perched, which we don't often get a chance to do, but they have a little tiny bill. But when they open their mouth, the mouth is probably about an inch and a half wide. It really allows them to, you know, grab easily whatever they're finding in flight, so that they can't. You can see them actually feeding on the wing when you're watching them.
I guess it's pretty cool there. And when they're migrating, then they can kind of eat as they move.
They do. Yeah, exactly. As long as there's enough light to see the flying insects, they'll pick them off on their migration. As probably a lot of people know, many of our birds migrate at night during the hours of darkness. So they're not eating on the wing, but there are some birds that migrate during the daytime or dusk and dawn hours that can eat along the way, like swallows, for example. Another example.
Tom Schultz, our guest today, bird artist and illustrator. He has illustrated a number of field guides, including the National Geographic's Field Guide to the Birds of North America. He does a great, wonderful job, and it's great to have him along here to talk with us about the fall bird migration in Wisconsin. Bill Volkert will be joining us as well. And you can join us, too. Give a call with your own questions or comments as we talk birds and the migration today. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mehler Show. I'm Larry Mehler. Breanne Chesso, our on-air producer here on The Ideas Net. Great to have you along on The Ideas Net as we take a look at the fall migration in Wisconsin. Tom Schultz, our guest. Join in with your own questions or comments. Maybe you've spotted some unusual birds this year. Are the birds starting to migrate in your area? Have you taken any bird trips lately? Bird questions, we'd love them. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mehler Show. We'd love to hear from you. Tom, you mentioned you do some tours. Are you still doing those tours?
My primary responsibility on the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, actually it's been for 37 years now, has been co-chair of the Field Trips Committee. And so we set up an annual schedule of field trips around the state primarily, but then we occasionally do some field trips outside of the state boundaries. And one of the ones I've been doing, I think 10 times now, has been a tour of Costa Rica for about 2 weeks. We went earlier this year, and we'll be repeating that trip again in 2018, so 2 years from now.
Well, that's got to be a fascinating trip. Costa Rica is it's a beautiful place to begin with, but the home of a lot of migrating birds.
Yeah, and it's great to go down there and see all the tropical species, but another aspect of it is just the opportunity to observe many of our Wisconsin birds, at least species that we see here in Wisconsin during the breeding season. They're down there for the winter period, either sometimes as migrants, sometimes when we're there in February and March, those birds are even starting to move north from South America, and we see them coming through Costa Rica. But there are places in Costa Rica where we see a number of birds that are common here in Wisconsin during the breeding season.
And I know Bill is going to be leading a birding tour in Nicaragua in February, so when he gets on board, we'll talk with him about that and how he got involved in that. And so I'm looking forward to that. This is, you know, kind of the time of the year we start seeing, at least on our Madison Lakes in southern Wisconsin, duck numbers start increasing. How many duck species are found in Wisconsin?
Oh, boy, that's a good question. I don't have a number off the top of my head, but it's probably close to 30. And some of those birds you won't see at all during the summer months. They're only here during the winter season or perhaps only during migration periods. And some of those you may not even see at all if you're on an inland lake. They're primarily seen on Lakes Michigan and Superior. And depending on ice conditions, some may stay all winter, but others just pass through or remain until as long as the ice conditions allow, and then they'll continue further south.
It's always fun for me in the spring, and in the especially in the spring, I guess, because you're really looking forward to seeing anything, you know, anything new, to see the mergansers and the canvasbacks and all of the various ducks that come through and do land on our inland lakes, our Madison Lake chain. There are always a lot of fun to see. What's the status? I'm going to switch and talk about loons for just a minute. Are you familiar with the status of the loons here in the state of Wisconsin right now? I know there were some trouble with nesting.
Yeah, I think in general the loon population has declined over recent decades, although I believe in Wisconsin they're probably holding fairly well. One thing about loons that's interesting that a lot of people are not aware of is that they don't breed until they're about 4 or 5 years of age. And so even though you see a loon in the summertime, it may not be a breeder. In fact, it might not even have the very distinctive coloration of a breeding loon, which a lot of people probably know with the black head and the white checkerboard on the black back. Some of those birds look like wintering loons, and I know we see them here on Green Lake where I live and in the summertime, but those are non-breeders that just aren't of breeding age yet.
I think it's interesting that the loon is one bird that will put its young on its back.
That's true. Yes, that's a great sight to see when the babies are quite young. You know, they're precocious birds, which means that when they hatch from the egg, they leave the nest within a very short time. They don't stay on the nest. They're right away. They're out on the water. They're almost like baby chickens from that standpoint, and they are able to swim around and follow the parents. And sometimes, for security and warmth and protection, they'll climb right up on the back of the adult and nestle in between the feathers. And you may not even see them there. Maybe they're just their heads are sticking out.
Oh man, it's a cool. I've seen some nice photos of them, and many wood carvers have actually carved the loon with the baby loon on the back, and that's always kind of fun to see.
Boy, that's got to be a challenge. To paint that or to carve that, and especially a young bird with a downy plumage.
It's got to be a difficult thing to carve. Well, you're an artist and an illustrator. You've illustrated all these field guides, and let's talk about that for just a minute.
Sure.
Talk about the whole process. How did you get started in this?
Well, it's interesting. When I was a freshman at the University of Wisconsin, I got seriously interested in birding. And then during the summer between my freshman and sophomore years, I just grabbed my field guide one day and took an old watercolor set and painted some of the birds right out of the field guide. I had always loved art growing up, but I never was serious about it. I didn't even take art in high school because I was taking math and science and physics, looking toward college. But then during my college years, I was drawing and painting birds in my spare time. And then, probably a lot of folks are familiar with the Birds and Art Show. It's an annual exhibit up in Wausau, Wisconsin, at the Leoki Woodson Art Museum.
Yeah.
And it's an annual show, usually runs from September to November. And I had been going to that show since it started in, I think, 1976. And so in 1981, I submitted a little watercolor that I had done, actually of a white-breasted nuthatch. And I was really excited because that painting was accepted. It's a juried show, and it's not easy to get into, but that white-breasted nuthatch was in their Birds and Art exhibit in 1981. And so the really fortunate thing for me was that that same year, the National Geographic Field Guide was starting on their North American bird book, field guide. And so they had obviously known about the Birds and Art Show and that it attracted the premier artists in the world. And so they sent their art editor, art director for the project to Wausau, Wisconsin, to the Birds and Art Show. And he looked through the paintings, looking for artists whose style he thought would be appropriate for field guide illustrations, you know, real representational, realistic work. And subsequent to that, I got a phone call. And that started me on the path of field guide illustration, which I'm still doing to this day. Actually, I'm working on that today, working on a contract for National Geographic on the 7th edition to their field guide. They generally have done a new edition about every 5 years.
Oh, man. So isn't it interesting how we sometimes we think we're going to go one direction and fate comes along?
Isn't that true? It takes you in a whole new direction.
And what did the pastor say? Chance favors the prepared mind or something like that?
Well, yes.
You had prepared yourself well, and man, what a career it's been so far.
Well, my college major was wildlife ecology, and so it was, you know, somewhat directly related to that. But when I was in college, I didn't even take art except for a couple of drawing. I took a drawing class, a basic drawing class, and a basic design class, just because I was interested and I had some electives to do. So, but primarily I'm self-taught as a bird artist and illustrator. But when you're working on field guide illustrations, the important thing is to try to paint them as lifelike as possible, try to match their actual colors as well as you can. And it's not always possible to trust photographs for that because birds can vary. Their color can vary so much in photos, depending on the lighting, the color reflection. If they're up in a tree, they might pick up some green tones from the leaves, reflected light from the leaves. So I work with museum specimens, and I have study skins, they're called. Primarily, most of mine come from the Field Museum in Chicago. So I go down there and spend perhaps a day or two doing research and selecting specimens, and then they graciously allow them to take them home, and then I work with them in my studio and use those to match colors and take measurements and so forth. And it's quite a process, and but it goes right along with my interest in bird identification. I've learned a lot from doing field guide illustrations because really to illustrate a bird well, you have to become an expert at its identification. And so that's really benefited me also in the long run in being a field birder.
Well, I tell you what, another person who's pretty darn good at identifying birds is Bill Volkert. And Bill just walked in the studio. Bill, retired wildlife educator and naturalist. He worked at Horicon Marsh for 27 years, been watching birds for well over 40 years. And Bill, welcome.
Well, thank you.
Great to have you here. How many?
My pleasure.
How many birds do you have in your repertoire? How many have you spotted over time?
Well, first of all, it depends on which checklist you use. Not everybody agrees on what's a species and what's not. I use the Clements checklist of the world birds. And I've got to keep a computer program just so I can keep track of things. 3,650 species, plus a few more.
Wow.
So a little over a third of the world's birds, which also means there's two-thirds out there I haven't seen. And no doubt quite a few I probably never will.
more than likely. Oh, Tom, are you close to 3,600?
Well, unfortunately, I don't have an exact number because I haven't really updated things as much as possible. But I'm sure I'm over 3,000 because I've birded in Central America, South America, and also over in Asia, primarily in India, when I was working for a field guide for the Smithsonian Institution on birds of, they ended up calling it birds of South Asia. So I have quite a few species, haven't quantified them all.
You got them under your belt, too. Well, it's great to have you both with us, and I'll put out a shout to our listeners. Now, if you have a question or comment about birds, we're talking migration. We're talking about bird art a little bit, too, with Tom here. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Unfortunately, we weren't able to get through to Tim Burkhead to talk with him about his book, The Most Perfect Thing. But that's okay because these guys are quite used to talking for long periods of time about birds. So join in, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. What experiences have you had with birds here lately? Maybe an identification question. Give a call and shoot us a note on email at WPR.org or on our Facebook page. You can also post a photo on our Facebook page, and we're glad to take a look at that as well. Well, Bill, what are you seeing through your neck of the woods? You live pretty near Horicon Marsh, don't you?
Yeah, over toward the northern Kettle Moraine.
Yeah.
And so it was always a short trip to work over at the marsh, so I always had that nice dual benefit of the wetland birds and the forest birds. But I heard Tom on the way down here talking a little bit about the migration, and the songbirds are really on the move right now. As you mentioned earlier, some of our summer birds are departing at this point, and some of these northern songbirds are coming through, but it's much more difficult to really watch for those small songbirds at this time of the year because they don't have the bright breeding plumage, they're not singing, and there's such a dense canopy. They're kind of sneaking through overhead, and unless you really get out and pursue them and peer for those birds there, they may very silently just pass right through and head south. Spring is different. You know, there's no leaves on the trees, or they're barely budding out. They're in bright color, and the birds are singing, so they really call attention. But fall is a whole different thing.
Yeah, it really is. And it's, I frankly, in many ways, I like the spring a lot better as I do my runs in the morning. It's just you got this little symphony of bird songs.
And I think most bird watchers are spring bird watchers. It is certainly the nice benefit we get from the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas, that it forces people to get out during the summer months to look for birds. But spring is certainly the best time. And also when we talk about the arrival of birds in spring compared to the departure in fall, spring is easy to know when the very first Baltimore Oriole or other migrant shows up in your backyard. There he is. You haven't seen him for months on end. But in fall, you really got to almost get out every day, check off the birds you're seeing, and then in retrospect, look back at, well, when was the last time I actually saw this bird and assume that somewhere around there is when they departed? So those kinds of dates have all been worked out for the averages of our arrival and departure of birds in Wisconsin, but it takes a little more work in the fall time.
Yeah, it does. Gary and Merrill has something for us. Hi, Gary. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Happy Labor Day. Yesterday or the day before, I saw a great egret in our pond. Now, we live on a farm, and it's only an acre and a half pond. And I was just wondering how unusual that is to see a bird like that in a pond.
Not that unusual at this time of the year. Now, both great blue herons and great egrets are colonial nesters, so they don't nest solitarily, but in large colonies. Maybe as few as a dozen nests, and we certainly have recorded large colonies along the Mississippi River of 600 nesting pair or more. Well, the nesting season usually ends for those birds as we get into early mid-July. This is when the young begin to leave the nest. So they're just moving just outside of the colony. They're feeding, fattening up, getting their strength, and trying out their flight feathers. Now past that time, and this is this post-nesting dispersal. So they're no longer tied to the nest site at all. The young are well grown up and very strong. And it's a chance to be able to explore beyond the nesting area for new food sources. And right now, fatten up before they depart. Egrets will hang around into early mid-October. Great blue herons, we usually see them departing in that mid-latter part of October, though we always pick up a few on the Christmas bird counts, especially in the southern counties where there's a little bit of open water, spring-fed ponds or little creeks and streams.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we've had the blue herons, and they're nesting in the woods along one of our fields, one of our hay fields, mm-hmm. and everything. And but this year I saw four of them at one time at our pond.
Well, you may have again either. If you're within about 15, maybe 20 miles of a nesting colony, that's far enough for a bird to fly out, try its luck fishing, and come back and feed the young. So if you're within that distance of a colony, you may be within a regular feeding site during the nesting season.
Right. Yeah.
As we get into late summer and early fall, we're well past nesting, and they're moving everywhere. And we also have, as we call this post-nesting dispersal, this just movement of birds way beyond the local nesting sites, we may even pick up at this time of year southern relatives of the herons and egrets that move into Wisconsin. So snowy egret, little blue heron, they may move around at this time of year. We also get them in spring, where some of these southern birds apparently overshoot the nesting ground, or maybe non-breeders that are just drifting and not tied to a nesting site will wait till the following year before they mature.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, it is. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. You know, kind of along with that, Heidi on Facebook says, I was wondering why some migrating birds appear to be going north in the fall. It would seem to me to be expending energy when the food is getting scarcer.
Well, I can share this. When I was at Horicon Marsh, I would get this all the time. Somebody would arrive and say, well, this morning I saw thousands of geese. They're all flying north. Isn't it fall migration? Well, migration is really that period where birds are moving deliberately from the nesting ground, making their way south to the wintering ground. And they'll do this in jumps and starts for many species. So they'll fly a distance, settle down, feed for a while, fatten up, replenish their reserves, and then move on again. But once birds are settled in, or even now for some that haven't yet actually begun migration, from where they roost during the night to where they're going out to feed, they may go in any direction. So there's a difference between this local movement while they're either preparing yet for migration or maybe have stopped over during migration compared to when they actually pick up and move. And Tom mentioned earlier that most of our migrants fly at night. Yeah. So during the day, they may be moving around just looking for food, build up those fat reserves, and then when the wind conditions are right and they're in good shape at the right time of the year, they pick up and make the next leg of the journey.
There we go. Well, Andy in Mount Horeb has something for us. Hi, Andy. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. Actually, I have two stories. I have a loon story and I have an osprey story.
Okay.
We were fishing a lake in northern Vilas County last June, and it's a very difficult lake to get into because of the landing. But we were there and we were fishing along right outside of an island, and two loons came up out of the water and did their display 5 feet from the boat. And I know what they were doing is they were chasing us away from the island because that's probably where they had young.
Yeah, it's very likely. loons have some very distinctive calls and also some distinctive behaviors or postures they'll use.
Oh, yeah.
For alert, warnings, for communication, so forth. And so, yeah, this sounds like that you're nearby a nest site, and they're just getting a little bit alerted and excited. And, of course, any nesting birds, that are they're all sensitive to human disturbance. If you happen to see that, you back off, give them a little the space that they are demanding. I mean, everybody likes a nice loon picture, but the last thing you want to do is to keep chasing them around in a boat or a canoe, tiring them out, keeping them from those parental duties at that critical time of the year just to get your photo.
Yeah.
So we've got to have a little discretion there.
Yeah,
and that's exactly what we did. We moved out of the way so we wouldn't disturb them anymore.
Yeah, good. Perfect, but, Andy.
But my osprey story is I used to go down to Florida for a week and a half to bass fish in the inland lakes, and we used to fish Lake Toho, which is just south of Orlando.
Okay.
And if you go down there in the winter, we usually go down in usually February or March, we would see so many ospreys on that lake, I just couldn't believe it. There was almost no time when you wouldn't see two or three osprey in the air as well as a bunch of other birds down there. So I know that's where they go in the winter. So
for sure. Well, that's a great story. Thank you, Andy, for calling. Appreciate it very much. Tom, there's Nina on Facebook says a pair of swallow-tailed kites was seen and photographed several times in Door County this past July and August. So she says maybe that's the good side of global warming.
Well, for those folks who don't know what swallow-tailed kites look like, it's an amazing-looking bird. It does look like a cross between a hawk and a swallow. A very large swallow, and they hunt primarily on the wing, I believe mostly dragonflies during the summer months. But a report came out this summer about a swallow-tailed kite, and the person that had seen it thought also she had seen two birds at the same time. Well, of course, that attracted the attention of bird watchers all over, not only Wisconsin birds, but birds from other states. And many people traveled to Door County, and some people were fortunate enough to see a swallow-tailed kite, and some were not. A couple people did get to see two birds together, although we don't know whether any nesting was attempted. Apparently wasn't successful if there were only two birds seen, but it was pretty exciting. I know for me personally, it was a life bird for Wisconsin. I had never seen one before in Wisconsin. I've seen them in Florida and Costa Rica many times, but it's a great bird to see. They're wonderful acrobatic flyers, zipping around on their wings and their long spread tail.
Yeah. Pretty cool sighting. Did you happen to see them, Bill?
No, but I've seen them many times in Central and South America, and my most memorable sighting was a flock of 16 of them as they were moving north along the foothills of the Andes. Actually, I wouldn't attribute this necessarily to global warming, because we have had other records of swallow-tailed kites in Wisconsin and the Midwest, and these are just the vagrants, the wanderers that get on a weather system, they're moving along, and all of a sudden they end up here. So it is a bird that's much better known on the far southern edge of the United States and into Mexico. But here again, it's not the first one, and I wouldn't say that the population is all moving north all the way to Wisconsin here. But that's what makes bird watching exciting. You never know what will show up.
Yeah, absolutely. Talking today with Bill Volkert and Tom Schultz about fall bird migration and just birding in general. I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Great to have you along as we take a look at the birds of Wisconsin and those who maybe don't reside in Wisconsin but come through anyway with our two guests. Bill Volkert, retired naturalist and wildlife educator. Tom Schultz, bird artist and illustrator, has illustrated a lot of field guides. We were talking with him earlier about the National Geographic's field guide to birds of North America. He's done several editions of that. So great to have them along. And again, Join us at 800-642-1234. Dan and Ripon up next. Dan, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hi there. Thank you for having me, gentlemen.
Sure.
I had a question and some stories. Question about the pelicans that have taken residence in Wisconsin. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that. And the one story is, well, geez, 2 weeks ago maybe, I was leaving work in Green Lake and was driving away and heard some sandhill cranes coming up behind me. So I looked up and behind me in my car, saw three birds, figured they're all sandhill cranes. And then as I listened, I could hear a different call, and this very distinctive call separate from the sandhill cranes. Looked back and realized it was a bald eagle. As they flew over my car, they went out ahead of me, and the bald eagle was chasing them, grabbed onto the legs of one of the sandhill cranes, and the two of them went down behind a house in front of me, so I couldn't see where they landed exactly, but they went down spinning to the ground, both of them flapping.
Wow.
So I pulled over. It was in a residential area, so it wasn't going fast at all, but pulled over to stop and watch to see what happened. The bald eagle got up, came over the house and flew away, still screaming really loud and calling really loud. So I was watching to see if I could see the sandhill cranes. I didn't want to walk through people's yards, so I was just on the road waiting to see if I could see something. Eventually saw the sandhill cranes walking and noticed that one of them was a much shorter sandhill crane, so I figured that must have been the baby from this year. But I had never seen a bald eagle attack sandhill cranes before, so that was quite
interesting. Wow, I'd never heard of it either. There was little video clip on the Internet. It was on one of the bird cams from out east, and they had it zoomed in on a family of osprey. And you could see a bald eagle coming in and actually snatch one of the ospreys off the nest.
Wow.
Obviously, these are really exceptional food choices for a bald eagle because we think of them primarily as going after fish. But I think, like anything, they're a bird of opportunity, and something seems to present itself. They may just give it a try. This is really extraordinary and incredible sight for you. Good for you.
Yeah, it was a big deal, so I was pretty excited. So.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Thanks, Dan.
Yeah, the other question I had is if you could talk a little bit, besides the pelicans and their move to the States, is the cedar waxwings. This weekend I was with my parents and I pointed out a big flock of cedar waxwings. And I know that they don't flock up during the summer, but they're flocking up right now as they're moving south. So I was curious if you could talk a little bit about that.
Tom, do you want to talk about that?
Sure. The pelican story is a fascinating one. And, primarily, probably 30 plus years ago, we thought mainly of pelicans occurring more commonly in the western part of the state, and they'd pass through in migration. And they'd breed up in some of the prairie provinces of Canada in the prairie potholes. But then something changed 20 plus years ago when they started nesting in the state of Wisconsin, I think initially up in Green Bay, but now there's a large population at Horicon Marsh and one or two other spots. But now it's a fairly common sight to see pelicans just about anywhere in the state, and sometimes in relatively large flocks also. These white American white pelicans is their proper name, but they feed communally in a flock, swimming through the water. If you watch them, they'll dip down with their bills into the water, oftentimes sort of working as a pack, moving through the water together in unison and seeming to drive a group of fish in front of them. A lot of times these are smaller fish that they're eating, but it's great to watch them. Bill probably has more stories about them from Horicon Marsh, too, and the fact that they're breeders there now.
Well, actually, myself, a good friend, Sumner Madison with the Endangered Resources Program, and a few other people who've been monitoring some of the different pelican colonies around the state, we put together a paper on the summary of all of the records of pelican sightings in Wisconsin, when they started nesting at different sites, and the surveys that have been done. In the analysis of that, well, first of all, the first nesting was Cat Island, Green Bay. That was in 92. And then they had a failed attempt at Horicon several years later, became established. Then Lake Butamore, the Mississippi River, and a few other sites are where they're showing up. But in the analysis of the data, what we saw was the growth of the population could not be accounted for just by what we call recruitment. In other words, the young being hatched in, maturing at 4 or 5 years old, and then them adding. So we're actually getting birds from the western states being drawn into these colonies. And what we find is they're really particular about trying to select the nesting site. But once they do, those nesting colonies are like a magnet, and any other pelican in the area that's of breeding age seems to be drawn to these very readily, and these populations can just explode in these areas. But as Tom mentioned, for the fishermen out there, their primary food choice are the small forage fish, the schooling fish. Obviously, they'll take anything that happens to get in their way, but they just kind of herd the fish in and then just scoop and pick up all these things. We saw them at Horicon several years ago. There were just hundreds of pelicans on one of the large impoundments. So Fish and Wildlife Service crew put up a net just to sample the fish to see what they were actually after. They said they caught so many of these little baby hatchling carp in it that two people in the boat couldn't even lift the nest out of the water. Just hundreds of them. It was just a super hatch, and they were just drawn to this food source and scooping up as much as they could.
Well, getting rid of the carp isn't a bad idea.
No, eat what you want. But, of course, they're an opportunist. They're never going to eliminate the food supply, but they may be able to suppress it.
What about cedar waxwings? Dan had a question about sort of about their...
Yeah, now is the time of year that they're flocking like other birds. They're all through the nesting season, and so the young are capable of flying, grouping up with their parents, and then those families and locals are starting to form the flocks. And they may stick around through the winter depending on food source. Now, in summertime, insects seems to be the main part of their food, and if you're along a lake shore with some tall trees, you'll commonly see them sallying up, grabbing insects out of the air, and picking food in that manner. But as we move into fall and winter, they actually shift their diet over to berries. And so if you've got crab apple, mountain ash don't last real long on the tree, but they'll hit them while they're ripe. And then crab apples can remain well into the winter, and we'll sometimes see flocks of these birds during good fruiting years hanging around. And they may even depart very late then, well after Christmas, once the food starts to diminish, head south and then come back again. Or some may just linger and just keep wandering and meandering looking for that random food source out there.
Very interesting. Dan, thanks again. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
You bet.
Vicki in Mount Horeb, it's your turn. Hi, Vicki.
Hello. I have a question for you. It's not Wisconsin, but it's not too far away. We're thinking of heading up to the Whitefish Point Bird Observatory in the UP. And just wondering if you have ever been there. And in the fall, is the birding, I know it's probably not as good as in the spring, but are we likely to be able to see a lot? And what might we see?
Mm-hmm. Tom, have you been there?
Actually, I have not traveled to Whitefish Point, although I've certainly heard much about it, and I know that they do annual bird counts up there. They have migration watchers, and they get incredible, amazing numbers of migrants in the fall coming through. Some of them are hawks, different types of raptors, but they get a lot of songbirds also. The point juts out into Lake Superior quite a distance, so that's the first point of land that many migrants see as they come across the lake. And so I would say, of course, it depends on the day and the migration, but some days can be quite spectacular up there. So you may want to make that trip and try to experience that yourself.
Yeah. Bill, have you been up there?
I have been up there. I've never spent much time to really talk with the staff, and I would certainly recommend that if the center's open to get in there and see if you can get some information from the staff or at the visitor's area of current counts and birds that are present. Yeah, and as Tom was mentioning, certainly the raptors is a big thing. They sort of funnel through there. You're also right on the shore of the Great Lakes, so you might be able to look for unusual gulls, any of the migrant water birds that are showing up. And you've got this nice mix of the forest, the coast, and the open water. So yeah, it's certainly a very attractive area for a nice mix of birds.
Sounds like fun, Vicki.
Yeah.
Hey, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Michael in Addison, your turn next. Hi, Michael.
Hi, guys. Thanks for the program. I have a quick story about Wisconsin and upper Midwest woodpecker. The northern flicker, mm-hmm. Used to be referred to as yellow-shafted. It's a funny story because staple in its diet are ants, and we lived in a not-to-be-mentioned mid-sized Wisconsin city where folks were really interested in keeping up with their lawns and lawn care. And we had two kids at the time, chose not to do that, not use pesticides, and is, as a result, attracted every ant known to the planet on our property. One morning, our small son looked out the back window. He said, "Dad, look at all the pigeons." I looked in the backyard, and I counted them. There were 79 northern flicker feasting away on all those ants.
Oh, my goodness.
That's very unusual, that many.
Yeah, and that's what I thought. I got the camcorder out at the time, and I thought, I'm not going to see this again, because in my own birding, I'd only see, like, one or two or a couple pairs at most, but yeah, I thought that was pretty unique sighting.
Yeah, definitely that high number. Now, usually as we get into that mid-late September is when they're getting ready for migration. Some will remain through the wintertime, but a lot of them depart from Wisconsin. And that's when I start to see these small flocks of flickers. You walk along a forest edge where there's a little clearing, and they're picking for ants and other insects on the ground. And I've flushed 8, 10 of them at a time. But certainly not 79.
And you've got the video proof of it.
Yeah, somewhere in our archives, I have to go back and find it. But,
must have been
that not only were we protecting our kids, but we were feeding a good species of woodpeckers.
Yeah, and it must have been a real hatch of ants at that time. This is also the time of year when they begin to fly, so they might have been out there that they're emerging out of the ground, and everybody just kind of glommed onto this incredible food source.
We're going to take a quick look at the news and weather, find out what else is in store for us, and then we will be back with our two guests. You stay with us. Taking a look at fall migration in Wisconsin and just birds in general with our two guests, Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator and naturalist, worked at Horicon Marsh for about 27 years. Tom Schultz, bird artist and illustrator. As I mentioned earlier, he's done field guides for several editions of the National Geographic's Field Guide to the Birds of North America, among other things. He's done a lot. He's been birding for over 40 years, board member, past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. So great to have them both with us. A story to share or a question to ask about birds and birding, I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Miller Show. Let's turn to Ivy in Evansville, Illinois next. Thank you for waiting.
I'm in Wisconsin, but I wanted to say that some of the best bird watching, particularly of warblers that I've had, is in my own backyard. I have a small yard in Evansville, and I landscape it with a mix of native plants and non-natives that attract wildlife and are not invasive. And I have three water features, and one is a fountain, and I've got it arranged so that there are sticks that birds can ladder down to the fountain on. And I've had a wide variety of warblers visit my yard and have gotten excellent. And just yesterday I was watching a female redstart in the yard hawking insects. It's been really great. You know, I might not get a whole lot at once, but, for example, I had a Cape May male visit my yard for about 2 weeks one spring, and it's been really fun because I get really good looks at them.
Oh, that's great. I just drove through Evansville, Wisconsin yesterday, as a matter of fact. So wonderful.
And we're a bird city, so I encourage people to landscape their yards for wildlife, and they won't have to travel all that far, and after work they can come home and sit out and enjoy the birds.
Thank you so much for calling in. And Bird City, that's a really a nice feature. Tom, you want to talk about Bird City?
Sure. One thing I wanted to pass along is Carl Schwartz, who was instrumental in setting up Bird City and sort of headed that up for many years. They're currently looking for Bird City number 100. We're up to 99 right now for Wisconsin bird cities. So if there's a community or a county perhaps out there somewhere, you could be number 100. But it's a wonderful program. Green Lake, where I live, is a member of Bird City. We have been for, this is our third year. And there are several criteria that a community needs to fulfill to be a part of Bird City, and all of them really involve creating awareness among community members of the birds around us and the important roles that they serve in our communities and in trying to promote habitat creation for them. They really perform an invaluable service in terms of pesticide control and reduce certainly the number of pesticides that we need to use in order to control insects. So it's really a wonderful program.
And there's a website, isn't there?
The Wisconsin Society for Ornithology website. Yeah. All the information about Bird City. So anybody who's just interested in the program itself can certainly take a look there, or if someone who's active in a community would like to get involved and become number 100, it's all posted there, the criteria and background. So, yeah, take a look at the WSOBirds.org.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Go ahead, Tom.
I was going to say, Ivy raised an excellent point before about mentioning the importance of bird baths, and it sounds like she has an elaborate setup. Some of them have recirculating water and waterfalls and so forth, and these can be a strong attraction for birds virtually any time of the year, but especially during migration periods and in the fall when you want to perhaps see some of the fall warblers moving through. They're challenging to find up in the trees, but when they come down to your water feature, that can be a great opportunity. And so I would recommend that for folks who want to do something in supplement to perhaps their bird feeding activities, because many of the birds that you get at a water feature would not be birds that you'd necessarily get at a bird feeder.
Yeah. And it comes down to the basics of just simply habitat. It's the food, water, and shelter. Birds need to feel safe. They need places to feed, so the native vegetation provides a lot of the food source for many of our songbirds. And as Tom mentioned, the addition of some water. You know, we're really concerned about bird population declines because of habitat loss. And it doesn't mean just protecting large areas somewhere out there. It's even your own backyard, and it's some of the most convenient bird watching you can imagine, right out your kitchen window.
Yeah, it's pretty nice. I have a water feature, small one. But the birds, it's nearby the near the bird couple of feeders, and it's fun to watch them come in. And actually, a lot of insects too use it.
Oh, sure,
bees and whatnot come in and take a drink and fly off.
Mm-hmm.
So it's
and just like a feeder, make sure you keep it clean.
Yes, yeah. Well, and if you don't want the water to stagnate or sit.
Correct. Yeah,
I change it out because mosquitoes could also.
Right, about once a week, do that, just like your feeders. We don't want to have the molds and things collecting among the old seeds, so keep those nice and clean.
Lorraine and Ripon, thanks for calling.
Yes, I see so many cardinals around here, and they have a beautiful song. And it seems like when I was, I don't know how many years ago, I don't ever remember cardinals around here in this area.
In the Ripon area?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, for Fond du Lac County, if my memory serves me right, I believe it was 1946 was the first record for that county. If we go back to the 1850s, Dr. Hoy, who did his work, early naturalist in Racine, barely recorded the cardinal in that far southeastern corner of the state. So, yeah, it was a bird that was really more southerly and just barely known to Wisconsin 150 years ago. And even within the last 50-plus years has been moving north. It's only within the last, two decades that they've made it all the way up to Ashland and the south shore of Lake Superior. So now it is a widespread bird throughout almost the entire stretch of the state. But, it is a bird that certainly has been advancing over the decades.
Yeah, that's fairly cool. Thanks, Lorraine, for calling. Jill, I didn't know that history. So it was 1940?
If you take a look at Sam Robbins' book, Wisconsin Bird Life, he's got the exact dates. I'm guessing 46, but it was somewhere about there. That was Fond du Lac County. And so there has been this documented northern advance of the cardinals.
Jill in Stoughton, it's your turn. Hi, Jill. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I have three hummingbird feeders out, and I have been told that I should not leave them out very long into the fall, as they actually discourage hummingbirds from heading south, and they need to do that. Is there any truth to that?
One word answer, no.
Okay, so I can leave them out as long as there's still hummingbirds coming around?
This comes up every fall that, if you put up feeders, you're going to keep the birds from migrating. No, you're actually going to give them the food they need so they can migrate. Migration is stimulated not by a food shortage, but the shortening of the day length. If they know it's time to go, they're going to go whether that feeder's out there or not. But we oftentimes get some hummingbirds that will linger late, and we may even get some of the unusual ones like Anna's and Rufus hummingbird coming through. Some of those can be quite late migrants. So keep those feeders out well through October, because that's the time to bring in some of the unusual ones. It's a quick stopover when all the flowers are more or less gone. So it can't be an attractant, and you might be able to lure something unusual to the backyard.
Good. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling. Along the hummingbird side, Elizabeth on Facebook says, I just saw pictures of a female hummingbird feeding a nest as of September 4th. That's yesterday. How unusual is this late in the season?
Tom, I just saw that posted. Somebody was taking pictures of the nest.
Yeah, was it Jim Edelhuber?
Yeah.
Perhaps.
Yeah, I just saw that this morning. He said he was at the nest, and that is a somewhat unusual late record. But, for a hummingbird, it doesn't take that long to raise a family. And if there's a food source and there's still a shot at it, they may just try to raise one more batch of young yet before the season's up. But most of it's done by now.
But from hatch to, hummingbirds, once they hatch, it's not long, not that many days before they're...
I'll guess off the top of my head, I think it's around 10 days is incubation, and normally your fledging period, the time once they hatch to when they leave the nest, is about equal to that. So within 20, 25 days, they could pull off a family. So if they're already hatched and in the nest...
No problem, huh?
Yeah, they might be able to do this. And the big trick would be, can those young then get out of the nest, condition themselves, and get ready to start heading south before the season closes in? It's a gamble, but whether it pays off or the young don't make it, they're certainly giving it one more try to add something to the population, and hey, why not?
Yeah.
But it is quite exceptional for a date for this late for hummingbirds. Most of them are much earlier, but strange things happen in the natural world.
Yeah. Mike in Linksville, you're next. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have a quick... comment about whippoorwills and a couple of questions I've had. I lived in this area. It's kind of near the Mississippi, a lot of bluffs and heavily wooded area. And behind my house, which might be about 75 yards till it gets to the woods, separated by a field, a narrow field, I had two whippoorwills. It seems like when they sang, they never were real close together. They were quite a ways apart, maybe a block apart. Well, anyway, every year they seem to, I guess I'll throw a question in with this explanation, if they're territorial or not, because every year they seem to be back here. Now, this last year, there was one whippoorwill. That's all I ever heard. There was not any more. And it would sing and sing and sing and sing for hours and all night long, basically. And I guess I would like to know also if they are, I heard they were ground nesters and maybe something got it, but as far as ground nesting, they would have to be quite high up on the bluff to get to, like, cedar trees or, berry bushes or something like that to get under it. Other than that, I do have owls. They move from valley over here and they nest up there every year and have their young, and then they're back on the other side of the valley. So now on these whippoorwills, I'm wondering if they are territorial, if they, this one left for some reason and went to a different location, or what could have happened. If you think I'll get any more back out here, because one farmer said, and this is a little small farm, one farmer said that he hadn't heard any whippoorwills for years.
Yeah. Comment on that. Thank you, Mike, for that story and question.
Well, whippoorwill numbers, like nighthawks, have been declining. And for people who are living, say, in near the southern Kettle Moraine, northern Kettle Moraine, it seems that they've more or less disappeared from large areas there. Eastern Wisconsin, they don't seem to be as widespread as they used to be. There are a few strongholds in that western part of the state and up north. But we really don't know what the reason for the decline is, but they are certainly a vulnerable bird. Yes, they are territorial. That's why they're singing, both to claim a territory and lure a mate. So they're very vocal that way, but it is a sound that has been disappearing from large areas in Wisconsin. It is a bird of real concern for us.
Yeah, it's a pretty song, too. I enjoy hearing it.
It's beautiful, yes.
Yeah.
They can go on all night long.
Yeah. Then it's not sometimes not so much fun.
So I just hope that the birds that he's seeing still continue to come back. Maybe it's just a one-time thing for this year that one of the birds may have been lost for one reason or another and did not nest there. But, you know, as populations decline, we oftentimes see around the edge of the core population, numbers diminish and that core area start to shrink. And that's the first sign that populations are declining.
Thanks again, Mike, for calling. I appreciate your call. I want to go to Bill and talk about birding Nicaragua because you're going to be going in February. Are you not?
Yes, we're going to take a group down again. I've been doing this for several years. I've been working in Nicaragua since 2002 on a variety of bird conservation and education efforts. And one of the things I did to help out their ecotourism, I wrote a book, Where to Watch Birds in Nicaragua.
Mm-hmm.
And that's for the independent traveler. So if people are looking to go on their own, that's available through myself, through Budio Books and Natural History Bookstore. And for those who are more interested in going to a group where everything's already organized and taken care of for you, we'll do that. There are hardly any tours that are actually going to Nicaragua. It's one of those countries that just isn't birded much but has tremendous opportunity. And we hit some of the premier sites down there. It's a wonderful experience. And so if anybody's looking for a detailed itinerary, more information, or would like to get in touch, they can just go to my website at BillVolkert.com.
BillVolkert.com. And that's in February 12th through the 21st.
Yes, that's a 10-day tour, and there's an optional 5-day extension where we go into far southeast into the rainforest. Otherwise, we're hitting cloud forests, dry tropical forests, Lake Nicaragua, wetlands and shore, and some of the really neat sites in that central part of the country.
And staying in some cool places, too.
Best places that I've been able to find and the best habitat down there, yeah. It's been a wonderful experience.
Well, Lee in Green Bay has something for us. Hi, Lee. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi. Afternoon. This is on the topic of the nighthawks. I'm about 20 miles north of Green Bay, and approximately, well, this happened about a little over a week. I had a flock of 15 to 20 nighthawks, three or four different evenings that I would see around my property. And one of those, well, it was early in the evening. It wasn't really getting that late. On two different days, I had them here. I was standing in my driveway, and they were gliding and swooping around me. Sometimes they'd come over my head 5-6 feet, and they must have done that for 5-6 minutes.
Oh.
Three, four of them would do it, and the other ones would be off feeding, and they would just keep swooping, and they'd go over the top of my garage, swoop over my head, and they're gone now. You know, they were probably migrating because I didn't see them during the summer.
Yeah, Tom mentioned that that the migration has been going on. Usually I think of the last 10 days or so of August and the first couple of days of September is when they're coming through. And being a daytime migrant or more that late afternoon when we'll see them come through, that's a good time to watch for them. So they can be quite visible. But here, it's a relative to the whippoorwill. They're all in that same family, what we call the nightjars. And they've been showing a decline as well. And I remember 20, 25 years ago, they nested on the buildings in the city of Fond du Lac, and in the evenings, midsummer, you could hear them right above the streetlights as they're catching insects that were attracted there. And I heard that from someone else, Sheboygan used to have the same thing. So the birds we're seeing now, the nighthawks, seem to have disappeared from those city sites. Along the lakefront, the gulls seem to be preying on them, perhaps the crows, and changes in the roofing. Used to be those gravel roofs, which were really attractive. You go to a black tar or something like that, it just gets too hot for eggs. So that's why we see the migrants are coming down from Canada. So the nesting population has somewhat shrunk and moved to the north of us, but we still see the migrants.
Thanks again for calling. Well, Bill and Tom, I'm going to throw a ringer here at you. I've got a bird song. It's not a bird that you're going to see here in Wisconsin. In fact, not even probably in the United States. So, think Europe.
Well, I better sit up and listen on this one. Okay.
Think Europe.
A little twittering.
That is a tough one. Think you can think United Kingdom, the UK, and you can think of a bird that produces probably the most sought after at one time sought after bird eggs in all the world. It's the black guillemot.
Oh boy!
Wow, that's a seabird, and that's a very unusual voice because it almost sounded like a small songbird.
Yeah, I thought I had that in for the other guest, but I thought I'd throw you a monkey wrench. And
good thing I didn't even try to guess. Yeah, wow.
Not one we hear every day, that's
no.
For sure.
No, that's for sure. Oh, man. Have you ever seen the Inaccessible Island Rail? Willie and Madison wondered that.
No, I haven't. There's a number of rails that are endemic to some of the different islands around the world. So these birds have dispersed, found these isolated islands, and over time developed as a unique species. And are also, as a group, some of the more at-risk birds because they are not flightless necessarily, but poor flyers, tied to these little wetlands, and known to just a single island or island chain in the world. So yeah, there's a lot of these rails out there that are very unique. The problem with rails, it's like looking for owls. They're really secretive. So yeah. When I go birding, you can the easy to find ones. You'll knock off a lot of the songbirds and the water birds. But these rails are so secretive down in the marsh, and I've already run into birders in different places of the world where they'll just stand by a little pond for an hour or so, hoping for something to come walking out. It's a real hit and miss bird, even if you're in the right habitat.
Brent is wondering if hummingbirds, he's heard that hummingbirds catch rides on the backs of geese. Not true?
No, another myth.
Not true.
Another myth. In fact, an explanation is that, Canada geese will go as far south as the Gulf Coast. Hummingbirds fly over the Gulf of Mexico to get to Central America. When they really need the help, the geese aren't there. I've heard other people say, well, they get the free ride to the Gulf, and then they can do it on their own. No, as extraordinary as it is, that little hummingbird, on his own power, gets all the way to Central America and back again every year. I don't know where that myth ever came from, but that's what it is.
Oh, well, I tell you what. Guys, thanks so much for being with us today. It's always a pleasure. I look forward to your next visit, and I really appreciate you spending the time with us on this Labor Day.
Well, thanks for having us, Larry. Tom, thanks a lot for filling in while I was trying to make my way across town and keep the show going as a one-man thing until I got here. So thanks for sharing it.
Oh, boy.
Thanks, Larry.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. Tom Schultz, bird illustrator, past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithologists, Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator. It's BillVolkert.com is where you go for that.
Yes.
Nicaragua.
Mm-hmm.
BillVolkert.com if you're interested maybe in going birding in Nicaragua with Bill Volkert. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.